From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. When Barack Obama was elected president earlier this month, many celebrated the fact that the United States had overcome a major racial barrier. But for every step forward, there are often a few steps backward. In the few weeks since Mr. Obama's election, cross-burning, racist graffiti, and other alleged hate crimes have been reported to police across the country. For more on the rise of hate crimes, we are joined now by Mark Potok, the director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Eric Osi, the publisher of the latest Outrage blog and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. Gentlemen, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks for having us.
Mark, let me begin with you. The Southern Poverty Law Center monitors hate crimes. Briefly, please tell us about the activity that's been reported since Mr. Obama was elected and where these incidents are happening primarily.
Well, I would actually date it to a couple of weeks before the election. It really began as it became more obvious that Obama would almost, very likely win. Back to around the time of the reported kill him shouts at various Palin rallies and so on. I mean, what we've seen, as you said in the intro, is everything from cross burnings on the lawns of people who voted for Obama to death threats to betting pools on when he would be assassinated, along with a sign saying, let's hope someone wins, to effigies of Obama hanging from nooses all around the country. Black church burned here where I happen to be today near Springfield, Massachusetts. There was even an amazing case of second and third grade students in a school bus in Idaho reportedly chanting assassinate Obama as they headed off to school. So it's been fairly remarkable out there.
Eric, you've been writing about these incidents. Do any of them stand out particularly for you and why?
Well, certainly the arson of the black church in Springfield, Massachusetts that Mark just mentioned. There was also a black family's car that was torched while parked next to their house in western Pennsylvania with Obama spray-painted on the trunk, and the 17-year-old Muslim youth who was beaten with baseball bats on Staten Island, New York on election night by a gang of four white men who repeatedly screamed Obama. Those are a couple of the more egregious things that have gone down. But There's been a range of incidents, and not limited to the South. This violence has occurred from coast to coast, from California to Maine. Hundreds of incidents, and according to the Secret Service, there have been more potential threats reported against Barack Obama than any past president-elect.
Well, Mark, to what do you attribute this? Is it strictly race? Is it the economy? Is it both? What is it?
No, I think it's largely race. I mean, I think what you said in the intro is correct. I think, history does not move forward in a straight line. So, I think that, we can all feel pleased that, that a black man was elected to the White House. It's a remarkable thing in a country, that has a history of 250 years of slavery and a century of Jim Crow, not to mention many thousands of lynchings. But the reality is these kinds of things do come with backlashes. I mean, I don't think, from my own perspective, that this was unexpected. What's a little shocking is how widespread it's been. I think there's a lot to suggest that it's purely race. I mean, one of the things that really points in that direction is an analysis of the voting in the South, where I come from, in the deep South states, where, by and large, the votes for McCain-Palin were significantly higher than the Bush votes in 2004 and 2000. And, what the analysts say about that is, the only explanation for that difference in votes is purely race. So, I think we're seeing a lot of things come together. We're seeing, Obama's election, a black man in the White House. We are seeing an economy about to, in terrible shape and definitely getting worse. And we have continued non-white immigration. I think all of those things together form a perfect kind of storm that's worrying at this moment.
Now, Eric mentioned, as you have, Mark, that some of these incidents have happened outside of the South. My question, Eric, is this. Do you get a sense that these incidents are random or isolated, or are they part of a more organized groundswell of racial intolerance?
Well, I think that Mark can speak to the white supremacist movement seeing Obama's election as what they hope is going to be a bonanza for them in terms of recruiting. We know that one of the most popular white supremacist websites got more than 2,000 new members the day after the election, compared with 91 new members on election day, according to an AP count. And that site was actually offline temporarily on November 5th because of the overwhelming amount of activity it received after Election Day. So I think that the white supremacist movement is going to try and revitalize itself. But really, we're seeing a few pathetic racists and violent extremists here, and they're lashing out.
Well, Mark,
Sheila,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Sheila Musaji of the AmericanMuslim.org website had a good perspective on these developments, and her take is that what we're seeing is the darkness before the dawn. It's the dying gasp of racism among a minority of Americans who just haven't realized that things have changed.
Well, you know, you make reference to the Klan, and I'd like to ask you about that, Mark, more specifically, because we know the Klan activity was high in the 1950s and 60s, and it seemed to have gone dormant, or at least underground to a certain extent for a while. But is it back now, given Obama's presidency, and to what extent might you expect it to grow?
You know, frankly, I think there's been a lot of hype about a Klan resurgence and comeback, you know, kind of on the shoulders of the Obama win, and I don't think that's happening. You know, you asked earlier, are all these incidents, you know, some kind of organized or many of them related to organized activity? And I think the answer is clearly, absolutely not. These are, you know, these come from individuals all over the place. There's nothing to suggest that there's any kind of organization behind these. These are really, you know, the kind of raging outbursts of people who feel that somehow the world is being taken from them, that, you know, sort of the country their white Christian forefathers created, you know, they've been robbed of in some way. You know, there is Klan activity out there, to return to the kind of second part of your question. You know, just last Friday, we actually won a major case against the Imperial Klans of America up in Kentucky based on their attack on a 16-year-old boy a couple of summers ago, a kid they called a quote-unquote illegal spick, and then proceeded to beat him really badly. Now, you know, that suit will likely put the Imperial Klans of America out of business. But there are, you know, 33 other named Klan organizations out there. So, you know, the Klan is there, but I have to say it's very small. You put all those different groups together, there might be 5 or perhaps 6,000 Klansmen in America. And the comparison, and this really goes off something that Eric just said, is the Klan in the 1920s, you know, which reached a membership of almost 4 million people, was very connected to real political power, actually ran political organizations in states like Indiana. So, you know, I agree that this is a bit of a last gasp, although I don't think it's precisely the darkness before the dawn. I mean, I don't think that we're not in a post-racial era. Racism is not going away.
Let me jump in to ask this question of the both of you, because I think one of the things that will be instructive about our discussion with regard to this is how the community is reacting to it and how the reaction of the community to these incidents differs, if it does, than how the community has responded historically to the actions of the Klan. Eric,
I think that's a real big difference, and I think it goes to what Mark just outlined for us about the Jim Crow era, which is that there was an active community support for collective violence against African Americans back in the day. You had 4,900 African Americans lynched or legally executed in 10 southern states between 1882 and 1930 alone, compared to just under 600 European Americans. And today, in 2008, rather than being standard among whites, blatant racism has been more marginalized. It's not to say average white people don't have their own prejudices and stereotypes, but the dehumanizing bigotry that defined America during the Jim Crow era is now discredited. And the community reaction to these acts of bigotry and violence post-election has been overwhelmingly to denounce the hate and to rally against the bigotry.
Is that your take, Mark?
That is my take. I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, there's just a tremendous difference between, you know, kind of racial extremism in a context in which it really does or is connected to the levers of real power, and the Klan and similar groups today, which are marginalized, very desperate people, very unhappy by and large, and, of course, looking at the whole world crashing down around them from their point of view. So, you know, one interesting thing in all of this is, you know, if you look at the Klan of, say, the 1920s or even the Klan of the Civil Rights era, these were groups that were they were essentially restorationists. They were, you know, let's get back to the Halcyon era, the sort of Garden of Eden when, you know, men were men and women were women and black people knew their place. You know, today these groups are so marginalized that their ideology has become actually completely revolutionary in the sense that they despise the American government and everything it stands for. You know, what they want is a race revolution, which will throw, you know, blacks, quote-unquote race mixers, brown people, Jews, and so on, out of the country, and they will make this completely, you know, sort of Aryan state.
I've got about a minute for this last answer. I'm going to bring it to you, Mark, because I'd like to know if you think there will be a change in the approach of the Justice Department now that an African-American, Eric Holder, is going to become the Attorney General in the Obama administration.
I do. I don't think it's because of Eric Holder's blackness, but I think that the Justice Department has been less than terrific at the very top levels, at, for instance, pursuing some of the civil rights era cases. I know we were invited to appear at a press conference with Attorney General then Gonzalez. You know, and the thing was a dog and pony show. I mean, they kind of talked about how we were helping them solve old civil rights cases, and that was the last we ever heard of it. I mean, the reality was, at least from my own point of view, that it was mere political showmanship. I think that's clearly not what's on the docket for this Justice Department. It seems, you know, from their number of indicators I've seen, that they're really going to move forward, and not only on old civil rights cases, but on present-day racism.
All right, our time
I just
is
want
up.
To mention that there,
time,
that there
unfortunately,
is a...
Unfortunately, our time is up. I'd like to hear your answer, but I just don't have time for it. So, Eric, let me thank you for coming on. The publisher of the latest Outrage blog and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post, and Mark Podek of the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Time now for our Africa update. This week in Zimbabwe, power-sharing talks resume as the nation faces a major humanitarian crisis, plus the latest on the violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. For more now, we've got Bill Fletcher. He is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans-Africa Forum. Bill, always nice to have you.
I'm always pleased to be on the program.
Let me set it up this way. The current political situation in Zimbabwe, it's been nearly 2 months since Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai signed a power-sharing agreement. But over the weekend, a group of world leaders that included former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and former United Nations head Kofi Annan were refused visas into Zimbabwe. The group called the Elders were planning a humanitarian mission there. Now, Mr. Annan and President Carter spoke out about the crisis in Zimbabwe.
Much worse in the sense that it goes beyond the traditional or the normal humanitarian situation where people need food assistance. The water and sanitation system seems to be breaking down. Schools are closed. Hospitals are closing. You have cholera, which is a danger to the region. And so from that point of view, it looks as if Zimbabwe is getting to the brink.
The crisis in Zimbabwe is much greater, much worse than anything that we had ever imagined. And obviously, the absence of a functioning government is the main problem that we face.
Now, before I come to you, Bill, I want to play one more clip. This is from South Africa's ANC leader, Jacob Zuma, who also spoke out on behalf of the elders and said a solution was urgently needed to solve the problems in Zimbabwe.
The elders, as I understood, they are not even coming from a political angle. It's a humanitarian that in any situation is always given a chance, even in a war. Situation. Humanitarian help is always given an opportunity. So it does give an unfortunate picture, I think.
And Bill, they were joined by the wife of Nelson Mandela. What do you think when you hear something like this?
I think that the Mugabe group is so desperately attempting to cling on to power that it is prepared to sink the ship. I don't think that that's their intent. In other words, I don't think that they think that they're taking it down. But they are incredibly desperate, and they're caught. They're really trapped because they know that they have to have some sort of government of national unity. There's just simply, at this point in time, no alternative. They have lost virtually all international support except for some fanatics in different places. This is an absolute act of desperation, and I think restricting the elders from entering into the country And restricting Grisha Marshall, I mean, the widow of Samora Machel, the wife of Nelson Mandela, I mean, this is just absolutely outrageous.
You know, one of the issues that I'd like you to respond to is this. In terms of Thabo Mbeki, the South African leader, trying to broker these talks, what good are talks when, in the past, the talks that have been held, the pact gets broken right afterwards?
The problem, part of the problem as I see it, is that President Mbeki conducted what he believed or described as silent diplomacy. It's completely unclear what the stick was in the diplomacy, though. It was clear that they were silent. In fact, many people didn't know that anything was actually going on. But there did not seem to be any way that Mbeki was holding Mugabe accountable. And on the one hand, it's a tribute to Mbeki that President Mugabe was willing to go as far as he has in terms of recognizing the need for a national unity government. But part of what it would have seemed to me is that there was pressure that President Mbeki, I believe, could have placed on President Mugabe by working up a closer alignment with Zimbabwe's neighbors. And that just didn't seem to be in the cards.
At the same time that there are difficulties taking place there, we have a similar problem, in a sense, now taking place in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where heavy fighting involving rebels, government troops, and pro-government militia continues. The violence has triggered a humanitarian crisis there, forcing an estimated 250,000 people to flee their homes, and we're hearing now that the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is ready to transfer tens of thousands of people in eastern DRC to safer locations. What is behind this?
What is behind this is that the Rwanda genocide of 1994 was never resolved. And by that I mean this, that after the genocide, when the genocidaires, the government of Rwanda at the time under the Hutu fanatics, was chased out of Rwanda, they retreated into the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, where they based themselves and aligned themselves with then President Mobutu of the Congo, what was then called Zaire. The situation of these genocidaires being based there, never being disarmed, for years being protected by the French, resulted in two wars and has resulted in continuous instability. See, this is a place, this is a situation where I actually do believe that the United States, under President-elect Obama, can play a very, very important role in conjunction with the African Union. And I know from discussion that I had with then-Senator Obama shortly after he was elected that he was very concerned about the situation in the DRC. This is a situation where the United States needs to deploy a special envoy. It needs to make a commitment to work with the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo in reconstruction. But it needs to work with Rwanda and the DRC on resolving this problem of the genocidaires. Because as long as these Hutu militias remain armed and unchecked in eastern Congo, I would suggest to you that there will remain instability.
Now, I've got about 30 seconds or so for you to answer this as we bring this to a close, and I appreciate your information. It's very valuable. What role are the minerals playing in this, the minerals that are there in that area and that nations like China are trying to get their hands on?
Very quick answer. Incredibly important, because the Congo is one of the wealthiest countries on the planet with regard to natural resources, and various groups, multinational corporations, militia groups, as well as governments, have basically been poaching the DRC in order to gain these resources to enrich themselves.
Bill, thank you very much.
My pleasure as always.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum. He is the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Toward Social Justice. He joined us from our Washington, D.C. headquarters.
Sing it. We will go back, go back. All land of liberty.
Now let's turn to West Africa. For more than a decade, Liberia has been struggling to recover from a civil war. The new documentary, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, is the extraordinary story of a group of Liberian women who banded together to end their nation's second bloody civil war.
Liberia had been at war for so long that my children had been hungry and afraid their entire lives. Some say the war was about the gap between the rich and the poor. Some also say that the war was about the hatred between the different ethnic groups. Others say the war was to control natural resources, power, money, ethnicity, greed. But there is nothing in my mind that should make people do what they did to the children of Liberia.
Lema Bowie mobilized a coalition of Christian and Muslim women to stand up to Liberia's violent warlords and to the corrupt Charles Taylor regime. Ultimately, this unusual group of women helped bring peace to their war-torn nation. Bowie told me what motivated her to organize the women of Liberia.
War fatigue, not having anything to lose because you've lost everything, being pushed so far back, physically, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, every way, that we had two options: succumb to death or fight back. And we decided to fight back, not in a conventional way of the cowards that we had as warlords, but as heroes and heroines, meaning we use our bodies, put ourselves out there, and conquer the evil force.
Talking about some unusual tactics to fight and to be successful with, one of them that you mentioned in the film was denying sex to men, kind of going on a sex strike. How did that work out?
Well, I must admit, in the urban area where I operated from, it was a bit difficult because every day we got stories of women coming back and saying, I had no control. But in the rural areas, it was really, really successful because the women, they had smaller communities. They were able to stay together and be together, so they were together for like months at night, keeping vigils, praying together, so they could keep it on for much longer time. But for us in the urban area, it was quite difficult.
Talk about that meeting that you had with Charles Taylor and what happened after you read your speech.
One day I'm sitting there on the airfield with the women under a blazing hot sun, and this security guard come and say, my boss wants to see you. And then I said, tell your boss I'm in my office. He should come down and see me. So he got out of his car, walked to me and said, why are you so disrespectful? Anyway, the president would like to see you all on so-and-so day. The thing was, Taylor was such a fearful person. No one thought that the women would come out in their numbers on that day. So we went and told the women to form a line. And they formed a line. And when this security guard just saw a sea of white marching, coming towards the place, he was like, oh my God. So on the way up to his office, they now said, the president is coming down to meet you all. He came down and they offered us seats, and we refused the seats and sat on the floor. And the people were asking, why did we sit on the floor? And the thing was, when we are running away from the bullets and the shooting and the fighting, we don't take chairs with us. We don't take beds with us. We don't take shoes with us. We don't even have food. So that was like symbolically saying you stop the war, our way of protesting to him. So after I actually read the statement that was given to me by instructions of the women, it was just an emotional time, not just for me, but for a lot of the women. I went to that meeting with a lot of anger in me. Seeing Taylor really brought it up.
Ms. Lema Bowie, coordinator of the Women Peace Building Network.
We are tired running. We are tired begging for bugger weed. We are tired of our children being raped. We are now taking this stand to secure the future of our children because we believe as custodians of society tomorrow, our children will ask us, Mama, what was your role during the crisis? Kindly convey this to the president of Liberia. Thank you.
Now, one of the things you mentioned, the peace talks, that was one of the dramatic scenes in the documentary when you went to Ghana and you barricaded the site of the peace talks, and you even prevented some of the negotiators from escaping through a window on the side. Talk about the significance of that. Was that sort of the last straw, the last stand?
It was either that action or getting AK-47 and killing everyone else in that room. Because we had gone to Accra with the hope that we were there for 2 weeks. And it was 3 months later. 3 months of people getting fatter, looking good, warlords who looked like nothing when it came to that peace talk. And it was 3 months of constant bombardment of the city. Death, 200 death every day. Liberia is a country of 3 million people. If you have 200 persons dying every day, you know that you're depleting our population. So it was just painful. It was the last thing we could do. So barricading the hall, and then the security coming up to me and saying I was obstructing justice and threatening to arrest me. It was like, it can't get worse than this. So since I'm going to prison, let me just strip naked in protest of the pain that we are feeling, and in protest of what these people have brought us to, because they had actually brought the people of Liberia to disgrace, disrepute, whatever word you want to use. We didn't have any form of respect in the sub-region anymore. So one Liberian woman stripping naked was nothing as compared to what the entire nation was feeling at the hands of few persons.
What about the reaction of the women who were both in the film, who had speaking parts, who were a part of the movement, as well as those that we saw every day out in the field wearing white? We didn't hear from them. When they saw the film, what was their response to it?
It was very emotional. I saw the making of that film, and every time I watched the parts, the pieces that were being put together, I cried. And that was the same reaction with every woman who worked, who was interviewed, those who worked. Because for us, it was like unbelievable. We didn't know the magnitude of the struggle that we went through, you know, because it was almost like a struggle for life. You know, not that we didn't place any value on what we were doing, but it wasn't like something you planned to do. It was a survival mechanism. So looking back at some of the things that we had to do because our future and the future of our children were at stake was something that really, really took us back again to tears. And I think people, after seeing the film, went back with the feeling that this can never happen to the people of Liberia anymore.
The film ends on a very hopeful note with the election of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Is there still hope in Liberia now, today?
There is immense hope. And one of the things that I said initially when we started this work, my goal was to motivate women to step out and do something for their future. The elections of Ellen has motivated women beyond, has given them hope beyond what we ever thought we would accomplish in our work. So now my job is to create opportunities for those motivated women and girls. There's so much hope, so much possibility within that country right now, especially as it relates to the women and the youth of the country.
Lema, thank you so much. A wonderful story.
Thank you.
That was Lema Bowie, who's featured in the documentary Pray the Devil Back to Hell. She led a group of Liberian women to end their nation's civil war. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. White collar and blue collar, move over. Green is the new thing. During his campaign, President-elect Barack Obama promised to invest $150 billion over 10 years to create 5 million new green collar jobs. As president-elect, he's announced a plan for an emergency stimulus package that would include funds to develop environmentally friendly technologies. The goal is simple enough: reduce waste and pollution while creating a new economy. But how much of this plan is possible in the near future? And where will these jobs be located? And who will get them? For answers, we turn to Van Jones. He is the author of The Green Collar Economy: How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems. Nice to have you on the show. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with this. What is a green collar job, and where can I find one if I need one?
Well, a green collar job is really a blue collar job that's been upgraded to better respect the environment. So you want to think about not the PhDs, but the PhDs, you know, the skilled laborers, the people who are putting up those solar panels, people who are manufacturing wind turbines, weatherizing and retrofitting buildings so they don't leak so much energy, people who are involved in water conservation, urban gardening, all of the hard and skilled and smart work that is required to help beat global warming. The good thing about a green collar job is everything that is good for the environment, that's good for energy independence, that's good for the fight against global warming, is a job. Solar panels don't put themselves up. And so the same things that can be used to beat global warming can also be used to power our way through the recession.
So green jobs would include things that require brain power as well as brawn power.
Exactly. You're talking about restoring the dignity of work, of skilled labor. We built this country with smart, skilled workers, and then we sent all those old blue-collar jobs overseas. Well, the good thing about a lot of these green-collar jobs is that many of them cannot be outsourced. If you're going to put up a solar panel or if you're going to weatherize a house, you can't send that building over to China or to Asia and have them do it on the cheap, bring that building back over here. Wind turbines are so heavy. They have 8,000 finely machined parts. Wind towers are 20 tons of steel. So it's better to make them close to where they're going to be put up, say, in our plain states. So you could put Detroit back to work. You're talking about a bailout. You could put Detroit back to work, not making SUVs that would destroy the world, but making wind turbines and solar panels that would help save the world, bail out the people and the planet.
Now, whenever new technologies are created, there are always shadow sides that are discovered along the way. What are some of the potential pitfalls, if there are any, of green jobs and technologies?
Well, you know, there are some concerns that, you know, solar panels, the way that they're made right now, the technology that we have right now, does produce some toxins. Wind turbines, for instance, we've got the right speed, so they don't kill as many birds. They do, though, unfortunately, kill an awful lot of bats. So there, you know, there's nothing that's perfect, but the question is, are those trade-offs worth it? If we keep trying to drill and burn our way out of our energy problems, our world scientists tell us we're going to cook the whole planet, and then we won't have birds or bats or anything else. So I think the most important thing we can do right now is to continue to try to invent and invest our way out by following up on the president-elect's green-collar jobs and energy independence agenda.
Are you suggesting there will be some energy-related collateral damage, if I can put it that way?
Well, there are always trade-offs, but I will say this. There are many more jobs that are available. For instance, there's something that came out called the Green Recovery Report from the Center for American Progress, where I am a senior fellow. And that report shows that for $100 billion of investment, you could create 2 million jobs in the United States in the next 2 years. Now, we're talking about 20 years from now. We're not talking about some space-age fantasy. We mean in the next 2 years, you could create 2 million jobs, weatherizing buildings, retrofitting buildings, deploying existing technologies like caulk guns, as well as solar panels to help us conserve energy and at the same time set us up to go from being the world leader in environmental pollution to being the world leader in environmental solutions as a country.
Let me follow up that point with this. Just after the election, we saw some infighting among Democrats in Congress. Representative Henry Waxman of California, for example, challenged Representative John Dingell of Michigan for chairmanship of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Waxman won that battle, and he is reportedly more eco-minded than Dingell. Does this signal, in your mind, a change happening on Capitol Hill when it comes to environmental issues?
I think it signals Capitol Hill finally catching up to the rest of the country. If you look at the polling data, Americans are very, very committed to a clean energy future, to energy independence. Riding the bucking bronco of gas prices creates a lot of uncertainty. Even when prices are down, you don't know how long they're going to be down. Americans want energy independence. Unfortunately, we've allowed Detroit, which is really the heart of our industrial capacity, to stay wed to a very outdated set of strategies. And now we have an opportunity. I think if we move forward, we can put this country back to work building the energy infrastructure to harness our clean energy power centers. and connect them to our population centers. We have a Saudi Arabia of wind in this country. We should never forget that in our plain states. We have a Saudi Arabia of solar in this country, in the Sun Belt. Our challenge is just to build all the things that we need to build to connect those clean energy power centers to our population centers and begin to lead the world again in clean energy.
Here's my final question for you, and I have less than a minute for you to respond. The president-elect's vision for a green economy, his stimulus package plans to include funds for new environmental technologies. Do you have any sense of what the details of that are going to look like?
Well, you know, my hope is that he will, set standards and let technologists figure out the technology. But I think that there is a strong interest in smart biofuels, advanced geothermal, certainly advanced solar. And the good thing is that, you know, low-income people and people of color who maybe did not have good opportunities in the pollution-based economy will have many more opportunities in this economy.
That's an interesting point. Van, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Van Jones is the author of The Green Collar Economy, How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems. Singer-songwriter Nika Costa's sound is a throwback to the days of funk and soul music. Nika came on to the American music scene in 2001 with the hit singles Like a Feather and Everybody Got Their Something. Now, Nika Costa is back with a new album and a new record label. NPR's Farai Today spoke to her about her latest album, Pebble to a Pearl. Farai started off by asking Nika about the album's first track, Stuck to You.
This album, Pebble to a Pearl, I just have to say the lead track totally, it totally gets me. And I hear a little bit of Stevie Wonder's Boogie On Reggae Woman and just the beat. If you stop the Milky Way, if you bar drink up every day, if you the town, I'd be the top. Did that inspire you at all? Or?
Oh, sure. You know, I was constantly, I wanted to make a record that brought me back to the music that made me want to make records in the first place. And that was, you know, early Stevie and Rufus and Chaka Khan and Etta James and James Brown. And so I was listening to a lot of that stuff just, you know, for inspiration. And, you know, so and we used a lot of the same kind of instruments and stuff. Like that's a Moog that's making that sound. And obviously, you know, Stevie Wonder used Moogs a lot. So
Moog synthesizer, early synthesizers.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
Stax, mm-hmm. which is your label, has been reinvigorated and reinvented. And Stax, of course, Isaac Hayes, the late great Isaac Hayes, mm-hmm. was on Stax. And, you know, I've watched the documentary Watch Stax about a million
That's
times.
Amazing.
So how did you end up on the new Stax after being on Virgin Records?
Well, I had gotten off Virgin and then made this record. And while we were mixing this record, I basically formed a record label because I didn't – called Go Funk Yourself Records, which I was just going to put this record out on my own. And, you know, we paid for it all ourselves and had no real plans to get in bed with another label. But Stax, through the grapevine, heard that I was in the studio and really just wanted to hear what we were doing. And they came in and heard it and, you know, just really loved it and really thought that it would, you know, fit really well with, you know, what they were trying to, you know, the kind of artist they wanted on the label. And they were just really aggressive about wanting it, which was lovely. And also they didn't want to change anything about it, which was really great and refreshing. Don't be afraid to live out loud. Never squash who you are. Be proud. You're a universal sound. Yes, you are. What you gotta say, say it loud. Baby, don't you act demure. Somebody else feels insecure.
I understand you started recording when you were 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
What were you recording back then?
Well, I made this record. My dad was doing a concert in Milan, Italy. And at the end of this concert, he said, "Oh, you know, my daughter's going to come and sing a song for you guys." And da-da-da. It was a full orchestra that he had on stage, and so I sang this song, Out Here My Own, from Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Fame was my favorite movie at the time. And it just kind of became this huge thing over there. And they just was just, she has to do a record and da-da-da. And the next thing I knew, we were in the studio making this record. And then it just got released all over Europe and South America and Israel. And it was just this crazy whirlwind of a crazy childhood.
My goodness. And with your dad working with Frank Sinatra, I'm mm-hmm. sure, you know, what an incredible family legacy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up around some pretty amazing musicians, and I, you know, I think it kind of got in somehow, but it wasn't like, as a kid, I wasn't super aware of who was around and what was going on. It was just kind of my normal, you know, upbringing.
Being surrounded with some of the most creative people in the world was
I
just
know,
your normal
I know.
Upbringing.
It sounds really like I'm playing it down, but, you know, kids...
Of course.
You know, kids are like, eh, whatever, throw me in the pool, you know? Like, they don't really care. But obviously, looking back, it's pretty cool.
When your faith lights the cannon, when your pride is pulling the trigger, when nobody...
You know, between Like a Feather and now, you have people who have become known for having this soulful funk approach to music, mm-hmm. like Amy Winehouse, mm-hmm. and who are white. Mm-hmm. And let's just be real. You know, there's a black vernacular that you're playing with, and you've never shied away from that. But do you think that now there's more room for people who are white women singers to play with the black vernacular in music and to find fans?
I've always been asked this question, even before Amy Winehouse. It was, oh, now you sound like, you know, Christina Aguilera, or there was that whole kind of blue-eyed kind of soul, whatever movement that was.
Christina's not as funky as you are.
Well, I know, but back then. She was, you know, whatever. She was white. She was riffing, whatever it was. Different kind of thing. And now it's Amy Winehouse and Duffy and, you know, before that it was, you know, Tina Marie, and then it was Dusty Springfield. And, you know, it goes on and on and on. To me, I'm glad that now actually I feel a little bit like the audience and radio have kind of caught up to what I've been doing all along, that now they're a bit more open with the success of Amy Winehouse and that they're a bit more open to this kind of music, you know, that maybe when I was making records, you know, early 2000, they were like, no one is going to listen to this, we're not going to play it, like, you know, no one's going to dig it, da-da-da-da-da. And now it's been proven that people like it if they just get a chance to hear it.
You do have a song that's a bit more sober, though, Bullets in the Sky.
The path of fear will be there to tread.
Are you more hopeful now? I mean, you know, considering that that's in a context of war, do you feel more hopeful about the world than those lyrics would suggest?
Sure. You know, I think with the, you know, with Obama being, you know, nominated, elected, I think it's incredible. It's an amazing time. And I don't think we've felt, and I, you know, have felt hope that anything could make a difference, or that our voices would be heard, or, you know, anything that it was remotely possible. I'm hopeful for sure that, you know, can't get any worse. Is that my last quote of the interview?
That's your last.
Oh,
that's
no.
Your last. You can invent another quote. Let's
oh,
see.
No.
Okay, last
one. That can't
one.
Be your last question.
Last one. What's your favorite song on this album?
Oh, okay. Probably right now I'm loving I'd Love to Love You Less, because it's just such a kind of fun song to sing, and it's very tongue in cheek. It's very sassy. And it's basically this kind of ballad where if you don't listen to the lyrics, you think it's some sentimental love song, but it's really about staying with this useless guy because he's really good in bed.
That's such an improbable scenario.
I personally have never been there. But
yeah, exactly. No, I can't even imagine it.
Well, you can't keep a home.
That was NPR's Farai Chidea speaking with singer-songwriter Nika Costa. Her latest album is Pebble to a Pearl. You can watch video of this interview and a performance by Nika Costa on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.
Half the time you own your phone.